Good morning and welcome to the Thursday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. There's no such thing as old age anymore, by Joseph F. Coughlin. Coughlin is founder and director of MIT's Age Lab and the author of The Longevity Economy. There are so many older adults in Florida that they've created their own city. The Villages, located smack in the center of the state, has a population of 157,000 people. By design and by fiat, virtually all of its residents are over the age of 55. The Villages has its own culture, its own norms, its own lifestyle. The primary mode of transportation is the golf cart. Tens of thousands of the little white vehicles crisscross the landscape. Accordingly, the community slogan is Free Golf for Life. 36 golf courses make up the heart of the Villages. It's the sort of arrangement one looks at and says, only in Florida. The state does earn its reputation. 20% of its population is over the age of 65, and over 40% is over 50. But Florida is not as unique as you might think. One of America's numerous and sometimes infamous baby boomers turns 65 every 8 seconds. In about a decade, the nation's age demographics will line up with that of the Sunshine State. We will become a nation of Floridas. Making such a society livable will require far more than golf carts. It will demand a great deal from all of us, entrepreneurs, employers, policymakers, and, yes, as individuals. In a world in which nearly half the population is over the age of 50, we'll have to start thinking of older people differently, more expansively. The first thing we'll have to recognize is that our very notion of old age is made up, an idea that in its modern form was only devised about a century ago. In the mid to late 1800s, antiquated medical theory suggested that the only healthy thing for older adults to do was rest. That since-debunked idea soon wormed its way into every aging-related institution we now take for granted. The first government pensions, corporate retirement policies, dedicated old age homes, and popular culture. Surviving well into the 21st century is the idea that older people are supposed to be consumers of ideas, work, products, and culture, but never producers, always takers, never givers. Today, ask anyone over the age of 60 or so if she wants to sit in a rocking chair for the rest of her life, on average, a far longer life than at the turn of the 20th century, and she'll laugh you out of the room. And yet, outmoded norms concerning the capabilities and goals of older people persist. They remain at the core of misguided products, policies, workplace expectations, you name it. As the demographic swell of the baby boomers begins to make its demands heard, however, that will change. Living longer and better may mean working longer. It may mean a lifetime of learning and growth. We may see older adults in roles to which we're not accustomed: retail, manufacturing, teaching, and delivering health care, not just receiving it. The energy we draw from our older population may grow to become one of our most valuable resources. Businesses founded by people over the age of 50 are already major sources of employment across the nation. Products designed with older people in mind must go beyond vitamins, walkers, and pill reminder systems. An aging society has given rise to a new multi-trillion-dollar market of consumers who want not just to be taken care of, but also live out aspirations once considered impossible in old age. These products, services, and experiences will become a source of economic growth and innovation, a new export to a world that is aging at a pace far faster than the United States, and a means of transforming what we once considered old into a new form of economic competition. In particular, technologies no longer should be built on the antiquated idea that older people must remain separate from society and at rest. Consider those simplified cell phones that only call one's kids and 911, a technology of universal connection reduced down to two contacts. Once upon a time, such devices made sense for many older adults, but as tech-savvy boomers age into their 70s and beyond, most will demand tech with full functionality that is also highly usable. No one who uses an iPhone now is going to switch back to a push-button device willingly, no matter her age. Note that pronoun, by the way. In older age brackets, there are fewer older men than women who already make the greater number of household purchasing decisions. Technologists and other product designers should make a female user a default when they design items for older people. For one, phones should be built for smaller hands. But as we become a nation of Floridas, we must be careful to avoid producing too many of those most peculiarly Floridian phenomena. Communities like the Villages. Nothing's wrong with the Villages, per se. Its residents are very happy, and that's the most important consideration about a place where people live. It offers a lifestyle that's attractive to many wonderful people, and a deserved respite from youth-oriented culture. But it also represents a troubling possible future for our era of longevity, one in which the young and old segregate themselves from each other. The way this could happen is simple. Society fails to recognize the needs, desires, and aspirations of older people, treating them as invisible, or worse, as a problem to be solved. We continue to write a story of old age that retires people away from everyone else, rather than finding ways to engage them, to activate their talents. In response, it's only natural that older people would choose to cloister themselves away. We can't afford for it to be this way. The challenge we all face is to actively build an age-ready nation. The longevity economy in the U.S. alone adds up to over 100 million older people, many of whom have the potential to live beyond the age of 100. We need to be ready. Infrastructure from housing to transportation must be re-engineered. Accessibility will no longer be a nicety or a legal mandate, but an essential feature of both public and private spaces, so that no one of any age will be shut out from the world. New rituals for post-midlife have to be invented. How about downsizing parties for when you move to a smaller home and want to give away some great stuff? Grandparent showers, midlife sabbaticals, celebrations for educational achievements in one's 40s and beyond, not to mention new forms of social engagement beyond cruises and golf courses. We need new signposts for how to live in what amounts to a brave new stage of life. Workplaces will have to learn to utilize the unique skills and institutional knowledge of older workers and resist the age-old urge to age discriminate. A new social contract for employers and employees will be written. Major sectors of the economy are facing a coming wave of retirements, and finding ways to keep an older workforce engaged may help ensure that key industries maintain the knowledge necessary to compete. Robotics will come to be seen not as a job taker, but a job saver, making squatting, lifting, and stacking possible despite older knees and hips in the workforce. A successful nation of Floridas will require so much more than van rides and pills and home health aids. More than anything, we as individuals will have to rethink old age, both for the sake of those older than us and, more selfishly, for our own future selves. An older America done right will improve quality of life across the board. After all, if we're lucky, the future of old age is the future for everyone. Pokemon Go creators will release a Harry Potter mobile game next year. By Katie Riley. The creators of Pokemon Go are launching a similar Harry Potter-themed augmented reality mobile game next year, giving Muggles a chance to interact more directly with J.K. Rowling's Wizarding World. Niantic Labs, the augmented reality company behind the interactive Pokemon game, is set to launch Harry Potter Wizards Unite in 2018, developing the game in partnership with Warner Brothers Interactive Entertainment. Players will learn spells, explore their real-world neighborhoods and cities to discover and fight legendary beasts, and team up with others to take down powerful enemies, Niantic said in an announcement on Wednesday, catering to players that have been dreaming of becoming real-life wizards. Pokemon Go became wildly successful after it launched last year. The game, which was among Apple's most downloaded apps in 2016, celebrated 750 million global downloads on its one-year anniversary.
Dan Rather, America is Stuck in the Purgatory of Tolerance, by Dan Rather. Rather, the former anchor of CBS Evening News, is the author of What Unites Us. When I was growing up, America was a place where privilege conferred on white, Protestant, straight, non-disabled men was not even questioned. This privilege remains strong today, but it must now compete with a growing chorus calling for a fairer, more inclusive nation. Legally and socially, we have made great progress, even if the summit of true equality and justice remains distant. We often hear about how we need to be more tolerant, to make room for people, ideas, and actions with which we may not agree. This is a prerequisite for a functional democracy. But tolerance alone is not sufficient. It allows us to accept others without engaging with them, to feel smug and self-satisfied without challenging the boundaries within which too many of us live. A society worthy of our ideals would be a much more inclusive one, a more integrated one. It would be a place where we would continually strive to create a better whole out of our many separate parts. This is a sentiment that itself stretches back to our founding. Our first national motto was E Pluribus Unum, from many, one. From many states, we are one nation. And from many peoples, we should be one society. Under this framework, building tolerance is a worthy way station to a much grander destination of inclusion. This is a journey that is in our power as a nation to make. The societal change regarding LGBTQ rights continues to our present time. We know that homosexuality is not limited to any race, religion, or socioeconomic class. It is part of human diversity. Once people have the courage and support to come out of the closet, families across the country, rich and poor, black and white, rural and urban, were forced to confront what had long remained hidden. Sisters, brothers, sons, daughters, best friends, co-workers, even fathers and mothers turned out to be gay, lesbian, bisexual, queer, and transgender. Now, how will you respond? Will you shun them and cast them aside? Many did and do. And the trails of pain, loneliness, depression, and even suicide are long and shameful. The tally of those rejected and disowned is large and continues to grow. But thankfully, many people decided to continue to love those whom they had already loved. They made room in their moral universe not only to tolerate LGBTQ people, but also to include them. Inclusion on race has been a very different journey, and I worry that for all the progress we have made, we are stuck in the purgatory of tolerance. This may not be a comfortable thought for many people who pride themselves on their progressive beliefs, but it is the truth. We have of late seen evidence of a great racial divide that remains, and in some ways even appears to be expanding more than a half century after the major legislative victories in the civil rights movement. While tragedies like the high-profile shootings of African Americans at the hands of law enforcement get a lot of deserved attention, these are symptoms of a much deeper problem. We are still largely segregated as a society, and our political divisions increasingly fall along the lines of race. The Republican Party has become whiter and more conservative, and the Democrats have become more diverse and progressive. This shapes not only how African Americans sort politically, but increasingly Hispanics and Asians too. Yes, we saw a historic moment in the 2008 election with our first African American president. But how distant all the talk of a post-racial America seems today. The election of President Barack Obama was a mark of progress. But the racist and demeaning comments from some of his critics, like the lies about his birth certificate, during his presidency, highlighted the intransigent lines of division that remain within our society. This environment has only intensified since President Obama left office in a political climate of greater polarization now emanating from the highest levels of government. The long shadow of slavery, segregation, and racism still looms over this nation. Building a more inclusive nation for women presents a unique set of hurdles. Keeping in mind that LGBTQ women and women from racial minorities face multiple forms of discrimination. As with racial justice and LGBTQ rights, we have made great strides. But I worry deeply that the biases against women have proven difficult to identify and correct within individuals. And this condition doesn't apply only to men. I have known many women who have had great talent and intelligence, but who diminish themselves in accordance with the expectations of society at large. When I was young, we heard often of how the United States was a great melting pot. It is a fine metaphor as far as it goes. But inclusion, not assimilation, should be the key concept in seeking, ever seeking, a more perfect national union. Our own history has shown that we are stronger as a mosaic than a melting pot. Our nation is bound together more by ideals than by blood or land, and inclusion is in our cultural DNA. We should feel proud that we are not all the same, and that we can share our differences under the common umbrella of humanity. We must confront the voices of intolerance and come to terms within our own complicity in condoning the divisions in our society. We have seen that progress is possible within ourselves and the nation at large. But it requires perseverance, hard work, and a commitment to respect the dignity of all who call America home. The Real Risk of Buying Medical Marijuana Online by Amanda McMillan. Many people buy medical marijuana online, but they may not always get exactly what they pay for, according to new research. A study published this week in the Journal of the American Medical Association found that nearly 70% of all products sold online made from cannabidiol, an extract of the marijuana plant, also known as CBD, contain either higher or lower concentrations of the drug than indicated on the label. That could potentially mean those CBD products are ineffective or even dangerous. Some CBD products examined in the study also contain significant amounts of THC, the chemical compound in cannabis that makes people feel high. Pure CBD should not contain THC, which is one reason experts say it has potential as a medical treatment and is not something that can be abused. The presence of THC is especially concerning because CBD is sometimes used by children with seizure disorders, says lead author Marcel Bond Miller, Ph.D., adjunct assistant professor of psychology and psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania. Parents could be giving their kids THC without knowing it, says Bond Miller. For the study, Bond Miller and his colleagues spent a month searching the internet and purchasing 84 products from 31 different companies that included CBD content on their packaging. Then they analyzed each product for actual CBD content, as well as other ingredients. They found that 42% of the products were underlabeled, meaning they contained a higher concentration of CBD than indicated. Another 26% were overlabeled, while 30% contained accurate CBD content within 10% of the amount listed. No studies have shown that taking too much CBD is harmful, says Bond Miller, although very little research has been done on doses over 1,500 milligrams. A bigger concern, he says, is that doses that are too low may affect how well the product works. Because of the variability between products, it can also be difficult for patients to expect consistent results. Say I have a kid with seizures who's in really bad shape, and I ordered some CBD oil as a last-ditch attempt to treat them, he says. If I happen to order something that has hardly any CBD in it, that's a problem. Number one, I might not be getting any therapeutic effect. And number two, I'm probably spending a decent amount of money for CBD that I'm not actually getting. CBD products sold in liquid form for use with vaping devices were mislabeled about 88% of the time, while CBD oils were mislabeled about 55% of the time. THC was detected in 18 of the 84 samples tested, and in some cases, it was found in concentrations that may be sufficient to produce intoxication or impairment, especially among children, the authors wrote in their paper. A 2015 study by the same group of researchers found similar mislabeling among edible marijuana samples. But the mislabeling of CBD products is even more concerning, says Bond Miller, since CBD is largely used for medicinal purposes among people of all ages, rather than as a recreational drug. The researchers believe the reason for these inconsistencies is a lack of regulation from the Food and Drug Administration, FDA. The federal government considers cannabis a Schedule I controlled dangerous substance and is not involved in production, labeling, and distribution at the state level. Right now, if you buy a Hershey bar, you know it has been checked over. You know how many calories are in it. You know it has chocolate as an ingredient. You know how much chocolate is in there, says Von Miller. It's crazy to have less oversight and information about a product being widely used for medicinal purposes, especially in very ill children, than a Hershey's bar. Last year, the Hemp Business Journal estimated that consumers will spend more than $2 billion a year on CBD products by 2020. One drug company, GW Pharmaceuticals, is currently pursuing FDA approval on a CBD-based treatment for children with a rare form of epilepsy. But beyond that, the industry remains unregulated, and Von Miller warns consumers should be wary of what they're purchasing online. The first step is ordering products from reputable sources, or getting advice from other people you trust, he says, or getting products tested yourself in an independent lab. The group Patient Focused Certification can provide names of nearby facilities that will test CBD extracts, he says. Unfortunately, the onus is on the consumer to do the homework.
We need to clean up our democracy, former DNC chair Donna Brazile on her new tell-all book by Philip Elliott. Donna Brazile doesn't care if you hate her book. In fact, the longtime Democratic insider hopes you're a bit uncomfortable with the publication of Hacks, the inside story of the break-ins and breakdowns that put Donald Trump in the White House, released Tuesday. In the book, Brazile describes a deeply dysfunctional Democratic National Committee, Russia's theft of DNC emails, and a miserable 2016 election that refuses to go away. Full of snark and shade, it has already become appointment reading for Washington. Brazile spoke on Tuesday with Time about her time as interim DNC chairwoman, the future of her party, and the fierce criticism she faces for releasing the book now, right at the one-year anniversary of Clinton's loss. This is a lightly edited transcript. How are you holding up? I'm doing good. I didn't suspect I would get such a reaction from what I like to call my former colleagues. I recognize that any book that would question not just some of the tactics and tones, but the strategy would get an ample response. Who knew a political memoir could break through? I thought the Clinton campaign would do a post-mortem and the election analysis since they controlled so much of the resources. I thought they would work with the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee and the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee and others to give a frank account to the rank and file of what happened. When I conducted the last DNC meeting before the election of new officers down in Atlanta, I brought in Guy Cecil because Robbie Mook wasn't ready yet. So maybe Robbie will be ready at some point to give his own postmortem. Many others have presented theirs. You can add mine to the number of other postmortems. Why hasn't there been a proper autopsy? I wanted that. I requested that. The Wisconsin State Party chair requested it. I put it on the table. I went to Robbie on numerous occasions and asked for a postmortem. He said the time wasn't right. He was going to work on it. He was doing it. I got calls from reporters. I went back to Robbie. I said, Robbie, people are still requesting it. The problem with the DNC doing it is that the DNC did not run its operations because of what I call the cancer, the memorandum of understanding, the joint fundraising agreement. We did not control the Victory Fund money. If you said to me, Madam Chair, how much money did you spend in Virginia in 2016? I don't know. I'd have to go back and consult with them because they had the Hillary Victory Fund money. I did not control the resources for the battleground states. It's hard for me to do an autopsy because I don't know what the polling or the data said. All I know is the hacking that we experienced in the DNC, the discord we dealt with the hacked, stolen emails, and the disruption that caused. I can only speak to what I know. I cannot speak to what they know. Going back to what you call the cancer, the joint fundraising agreement, doesn't this happen every 4 years? What made this one different? It was the addendum to the joint fundraising agreement. I'm a former campaign manager. I was an officer of the Democratic Party. I didn't learn about it until I kept getting blocked from hiring staff or trying to terminate people to write what I found was wrong at the DNC when I came in. When I found out, I felt obligated to go and tell Bernie, "Here's the cancer. I'm not killing the patient." So it was rigged? I just don't like the word rigged because states control the primaries, not the DNC. The voting was not rigged. The independence of the DNC was jeopardized, and that was wrong. The word I use is cancer because what I found in the separate document between the Clinton campaign and the DNC was a form of cancer. The control that the Clinton camp had over the DNC made it difficult for me to do my job as chair. Did the agreement change the outcome of the nomination fight? No. As you know, in the months that follow a presidential cycle, the Rules and Bylaws Committee reconvenes to look at the procedure from the 2012 campaign, and then we use that procedure to begin to draw upon those lessons for 2016. We made some changes in regards to bonus delegates. We made some changes in terms of representation in some of the state delegations. We made no changes that I thought would have indicated the party itself was trying to stack the deck for one candidate over another. Hillary won 3 of the first 4 contests. Those are the contests that typically give you momentum. She regained some altitude in Super Tuesday. Then Bernie gained some altitude in the Michigan, Wisconsin. It came down to New York. Eventually, she had more delegates, both pledged as well as unpledged. She had more voters. I still believe Bernie ran a hell of a campaign. He ran against the establishment inside the Democratic Party as well as outside the Democratic Party. He ran a campaign based on the great principles that Democrats believe in, giving everyone a fair chance, making college more affordable. He ran on a single-payer system. He ran a very energetic campaign. He brought new people to the party. I think his message that Democrats heard was to open the party up to allow more non-Democrats to get involved. Is Bernie the future of the party? I don't know. Not since 2000 have I worked on a political campaign. I'm not ready to tell you who I'm going to work for in 2020. Right now, I would hope the party would continue to make gains and strengthen the internal dynamics of the party so we can go out there in 2018 and beyond to represent the future and what the country wants. Why are you writing this book, and why now? When I left my position as chair, I was quite frustrated with what I call the pace of change. I spent much of 2016, at least the part when I was chair, trying to get reporters and the American people to understand that we were attacked. I started writing columns. I wanted to put as much information out there as possible. I felt something was missing. I came to the month of May, and I'm like, we're still without a PM? We're still without a full analysis of what happened? I decided I would look inside the party and say, okay, here's what happened. I want to learn and pass along the lessons of 2016. We need to learn from last year. The rank-and-file Democrats need to know what happened, what the party has been doing in their name, with their votes, and with their money. That's why I wrote the book. I wrote a book after the 2000 campaign called Cooking with Grease. I tell my friends up at Harvard, every time the winner of the popular vote loses the Electoral College, I get to come to Harvard. Every time this happens, I get to write a book. That's grim. At 57, I don't know how much gas I have left in my tank. I'm the person who is often called to come and clean up the mess. This time, I wasn't just willing to clean up what I found on the surface. I went deep. I went way deep. I know there are many of my friends who will never have me over for Thanksgiving now. To them, I say this. I'd much rather a seat at the table when I know everybody can be included, rather than to come into a room that is not clean and needs of some disinfecting. We need to clean up our democracy. We need to clean up both political parties. If my voice can be a catalyst to get people talking about how we run our campaigns in the future and how we strengthen our democracy, then I will be pleased. My decision, just like Hillary's decision to write her book and Bernie's decision to write his book and Joe Biden's decision to write his and many, many others, is to tell my truth. I ask people to respect that I have that right. Knowing what you know now, would you have taken the DNC job? About 3 months before I became interim chair, I got a job offer to work for a big, big, big corporation. It was a great job, paying seven figures. I'll never forget when I told the CEO of that company that I wanted to put a woman in the White House. Once that's done, I'll be able to come and finally get a job outside of politics. I have no regrets. I support Hillary. I wanted Hillary to win. I wanted her to defeat Donald Trump. I wanted to see a woman in the White House. I also wanted to make it very clear there are seats for everybody at the table, not just those who have been in the process all of their adult lives. Stop using antibiotics in healthy animals, World Health Organization says. By Alexandra Sifferlin. About 80% of antibiotics worldwide are used in animals, something health experts say is contributing to the growing problem of antibiotic resistance, in which common infections no longer respond to the drugs used to treat them. Now, the World Health Organization, the WHO, has released new recommendations for antibiotic use in animals, taking a strong position that the use of medically important antibiotics should be substantially dialed back, and that the use of antibiotics for growth promotion should be banned altogether. The WHO is also recommending that healthy animals only receive antibiotics to prevent illness if a disease is already diagnosed in that animal's flock or herd. When veterinarians do treat animals, the WHO says they should only use medications that are of least importance to human health. Antibiotics that are used in animals are either identical or very similar to antibiotics used in humans, which is why they contribute to the increase in infections among humans who don't respond to the drugs. The WHO says the potential consequences from completely restricting antibiotics for growth promotion appear to be relatively small or non-existent. Whether countries will heed the new recommendations remains to be seen. Countries will follow these guidelines if they are sufficiently impressed with how urgent this crisis is and if they have good leadership, says Dr. David Wallinga, a senior health officer at the Natural Resources Defense Council, the NRDC. Wallinga, who served on the WHO's Guidelines Development Group, calls the recommendations terrific, adding that some countries already follow these best practices. I think the guidelines can work because it has worked, he says. We have several examples of countries that have enacted these steps exactly and have seen remarkable decreases in their overall use of medically important antibiotics in just a couple of years. The Netherlands, for example, has reduced antibiotic use in animals by nearly 60%, and Namibia no longer uses antibiotics in its beef production. In 2006, the European Union banned the use of antibiotics in animals for growth promotion. The U.S. just officially restricted the use of antibiotics for growth promotion in 2017. Consumer support for more judicious antibiotics use has also led to major changes in industry behavior. Both McDonald's and Tyson are no longer using antibiotics that are important to human medicine, for example. Still, experts say more needs to be done across agriculture, medicine, and drug development to get ahead of the problem. In the U.S., at least 2 million people contract infections that are resistant to antibiotics, and at least 23,000 people will die from them each year. A lack of effective antibiotics is as serious a security threat as a sudden and deadly disease outbreak, the Director General of the WHO said in a statement about the new report. Strong, sustained action across all sectors is vital if we're to turn back the tide of antimicrobial resistance and keep the world safe. The Trump administration ended protection for Nicaraguans who fled disaster. These three countries could be next. By Maya Roden. The Trump administration is moving to end a program that allowed some Nicaraguan citizens who fled after a natural disaster to stay in the U.S. as part of an overall stricter approach to immigration. The decision to end temporary protected status for Nicaraguan refugees means that some 2,500 people will no longer be permitted to live in the United States as of January 5, 2019, and similar protections for other countries could end soon as well. Acting Homeland Security Secretary Elaine Duke announced Monday that temporary protected status will be extended for around 57,000 Hondurans for 6 months after the current designation expires in January. But in a statement, she said that extension was needed to assess conditions in Honduras. Similar decisions on the status of 190,000 El Salvadorans and 50,000 Haitians living in the U.S. have yet to be made, and Vox reports that the State Department believes the status should be ended for all four countries, which account for most of the 300,000 people who have temporary protected status in the U.S. today. The Trump administration has taken a hard-line stance on immigration, calling for more deportations, attempting to withhold funding for sanctuary cities, and ending an Obama-era program that allowed undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children to avoid deportation. It appears to be extending this approach to temporary protected status, a long-standing program that allows immigrants to live and work in the U.S. if they cannot safely return to their home countries due to natural disaster or ongoing conflict. In order to qualify, citizens must have been living in the U.S. continuously when the designation was put in place, and they have to have limited criminal histories. Before the program existed, the executive branch had the power to offer some countries extended voluntary departure, according to the Migration Policy Institute. But unlike temporary protected status, no specific criteria had to be met in order to qualify, and designations were often motivated by politics. Temporary protected status is not a pathway to legal U.S. citizenship. Though those who receive it are safe from deportation, they do not receive green cards and they are not eligible to apply for citizenship or legal permanent residence simply because they're free to stay. Each individual, if they want to transition from temporary protected status to a green card, has to qualify within one of the existing green card categories, such as marrying a U.S. citizen or having an employer sponsor them, explains Cornell Law professor Stephen Yale Lohr. There's no easier path to a green card for people who have temporary protected status. Because the designations are supposed to be temporary, the U.S. government determines whether to extend the protection regularly for periods ranging from 6 to 18 months, though the status can be maintained for as long as the government sees fit. Doris Meisner of the Migration Policy Institute says the statute is an effort to find a balance in circumstances where the U.S. has a strong interest, both from a humanitarian standpoint and a foreign policy perspective, in helping people from certain countries without granting them full citizenship. When disaster strikes and the U.S. has an interest in maintaining the stability of the country or region, this protection is an option. Meisner says that keeping the program temporary can pose a challenge. This kind of rebuilding when there's a massive disaster takes time. Nicaragua and Honduras, for example, have been under TPS since 1999 when a devastating hurricane hit, killing more than 11,000 Central Americans. Citizens of those countries who have been in the U.S. continuously since December 30, 1998, have been allowed to stay and work as long as they have not committed a felony or two or more misdemeanor offenses and have not committed some drug and national security offenses. Yale Lohr says taking the status away has presented political challenges for administrations over the years. Individuals from those countries settle here, they have roots, they marry U.S. citizens, they have U.S. citizen children, he says. So if you take it away, then you're dividing families and sending some people back to their home country. The Trump administration's decision to end the status for Nicaraguans and leave thousands of Hondurans and Haitians and El Salvadorans worried about their future has elicited a flurry of negative reactions from immigration advocates and lawmakers who have repeatedly accused the Trump administration of looking for any and every excuse to give immigrants the boot. This administration seems uninterested in keeping families together, in keeping essential workers in critical industries, or in keeping neighboring countries from becoming failed states, said Frank Sherry of America's Voice Education Fund. They seem to care more about getting applause from the right-wingers who want to drive out immigrants, keep out refugees, ban Muslims, and slash legal immigration. Meisner says the administration's decision to wait could mean something else. It does seem to me that they're being forced to grapple with that hardline position that they've taken, she says. They're trying to straddle a line between what they've promised to the hardline constituencies that they feel accountable to and the broader realities of what it actually means to be managing these issues. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.